What's up, everybody? Welcome to this week's episode of Hidden Forces with me, Dimitri Kafinas. My guest for this episode is philosopher and anthropologist Patrick Grimm. Dr. Grimm has been awarded the President and Chancellor's Awards for Excellence in Teaching and was elected to the Academy of Teachers and Scholars. Named the Weinberg Distinguished Visiting Professor at the University of Michigan in 2006, Professor Grimm has also held visiting fellowships at the Center for Complex Systems at Michigan and at the Center for Philosophy and Science at the University of Pittsburgh. He is the author of The Incomplete Universe, Totality, Knowledge, and Truth, co-author of The Philosophical Computer, Exploratory Essays in Philosophical Computer Modeling, and editor of the forthcoming Mind and Consciousness, Five Questions. He is widely published in scholarly journals and serves as the founder and co-editor of 25 volumes of The Philosopher's Annual, an anthology of the best articles published in philosophy each year. For more information about today's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod for regular updates and audience feedback, including the latest information about future episodes, topics, and guests. And now, let's get right to this week's conversation. Dr. Grimm, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Thank you.
It's great having you on the program. I'm very excited to have you on. So tell me, when did you first become interested in existential questions and questions of philosophy dealing with the mind-body problem?
As a teenager, I'm sure. I think even before that. I think even as a child, I think back and there are occasions when I remember walking along the street and convincing myself that I'd invented the idea of reincarnation. I don't think you can pose that without at least having the categories of the mind-body problem.
That's interesting. What do you mean you invented the idea that...
Oh, I mean, I convinced myself I invented it. I convinced myself with all the hubris of, probably a 5 or 6 year old that this was an idea that was somehow new.
This is obviously without having studied the literature. Did you have some theological foundation that gave you a sense of the concept of reincarnation or immortality or the afterlife?
I think undoubtedly that's true. I was raised in a Presbyterian tradition, and all of the concepts are there, including difficulties of free will that come along with Calvinism.
Well, that's very interesting. Well, you know, just for the knowledge of our audience, I'm not sure whether I learned about you from your student Carissa Flocken, or if I had first heard your Great Courses series and then spoke to Carissa. But in either case, I have heard your lecture. And in fact, I believe it's the second most popular lecture on the Great Courses behind the Bible, if I'm not mistaken. So it's extremely popular, and I would highly recommend it to our listeners. And it has formed, I think, the foundation for much of today's discussion in terms of how I've structured it. And you do an amazing job in that lecture, and you start by laying out the intellectual foundation for this problem, for the mind-body problem, which I think is somewhat, if not entirely, synonymous with the hard problem of consciousness. Can you lay that out for our audience as sort of you have in your lectures or as it's progressed since then for you so that they can get a sense of what this is that we're going to discuss today?
I think it's hard to track the full history of the mind-body problem. Part of it is the categories themselves. It's easy to track it from Descartes, who's a seminal figure in the 17th century. From there on, the categories are very much ours. On the other hand, it's clear that there are elements of the mind-body problem that are evident in not only in Plato, but before Plato, that are evident in Hindu traditions, the Indian traditions, in Buddhism. The concepts are evident probably through the Pythagoreans from Orphic traditions that come from buried sources in the East. So actually trying to trace that history is a very difficult one. It's as difficult as trying to trace the history of the concept of the soul, which seems like it should be a simple one. But when you track it down, there are different concepts that are sort of like our concept of a soul or the one we're familiar with, ones that are slightly different. It very much ends up in trying to understand aspects of a different culture through imperfect translations. I don't think that really answered your question, Dimitri. ask me again and see if I can do a better job.
Well, you touched on many things that we're going to get into. You're basically getting to the pre-Socratic philosophers and the progression of philosophic thought in the West through Socrates, through Aristotle with the soul, through Descartes, etc. And you touched on the Eastern traditions. And I want to get into all of those in a sort of historical overview of this. But just in terms of the way that people tend to think about this question today, I believe there's a sort of traditional materialist perspective, which I think is evident in the works of people like Daniel Dennett or Richard Dawkins. It's sort of the traditional approach that there is one way to understand consciousness, and that is within the physical world. It comes from the physical, and so the answers to it must reside there. And there is also an idealist view, which is, I think, today considered more kooky, sort of by the mainstream establishment, but that was something that would have fallen. Well, Plato, I guess, was dualist in a way because there was a materialist component as well, but it's an idea that consciousness is a realm in and of itself, and that everything emanates from that. And then there's this dualistic perspective. Can you give us some sense of these categories and to help us make sense of that? Understanding, of course, that there is a transmutation and that these are not perfectly sort of siloed interpretations that have traveled immutably through time from the pre-Socratics to today.
Let me try to give you a thumbnail history. You're right that common contemporary categories for approaching the mind-body problem are materialism is one of them, with stronger and weaker shades of materialism. But the idea is that the entire universe is a physical universe. If the mind has a place in the universe, it has to have a physical place. There has to be something material, something physical about it. Yes, the sort of left field, although it has a strong history, is idealism, that what the universe is really made of is on the subjective side, that somehow what's real is the conceptual, is the subjective, that we somehow construct the objective out of that. And then in the middle is a group of people, of whom Descartes is a prime representative, who are attempting to keep a foot in both worlds, where you have two kinds of substance, it is in Descartes, the material and the mental. And then, of course, the question is how those two get together. In fact, every one of those positions has a difficulty built in. If you're a materialist, the problem is to try to understand or try to explain what the role of something that appears so different in a physical universe, namely the mental, what physical role that has. If you're an idealist, the problem is how do you explain the apparently objective, independent of us, objective world, if it's in the end to be constructed out of merely subjective elements. And if you're a dualist, the problem, which is still very much the problem of the mind-body problem, even in contemporary brain science terms, is if there are two, at least apparently, different realms, the mental and the physical, how can they get together? How can they interact? How can it be that the physical influences the mental and vice versa if they're basically two distinct realms? That's the setup. The history is you can find representatives of each of those views, certainly back in the ancient Greeks. So if you try to track where philosophy comes from, where at least Western philosophy comes from, people tend to say Athens, but in order to really track it down, you have to go about 200 miles east of Athens to Miletus in Ionia. It's now within Turkey. And that's where what are recorded in the Greek tradition as the first philosophers, and they're recorded as such by Diogenes Laertes, by the Greeks, are Thales in 600 BC, Anaximenes in 550, Heraclitus in 500, the Atomists in 400 BC. And what all of them are asking is, what is the cosmos made of? What is the universe made of? And they're all materialists. Thales says it's essentially water. Anaximenes says it's air. Heraclitus says it's fire. The Atomists, Leucippus and Democritus, are closer to our view of little particles somehow make up the universe. But for all of them, it's a material universe, and for all of them, the position of mind has to be somehow material. when you get to Plato, you get elements of both idealism and dualism. Idealism, because he thought that what was real was what we consider ideal. If you think of a geometry teacher in junior high or high school may have told you when he or she drew a triangle on the board and said, now this isn't the triangle we're talking about because my lines aren't straight, because my angles aren't perfect, because my lines have thickness. We're talking about the real triangle, the ideal triangle. Well, that really is Plato's view, that what's real in the world is that kind of thing, that kind of abstract object, and the physical triangle on the blackboard is a poor shadow, is an echo, is an imperfect material instantiation of that. And then in Plato, you get a dualism where he spoke in terms of soul, but mind is right there. Probably soul and mind are very close for Plato. But he's got a dualism where in the Phaedo, for example, which is the dialogue of the death of Socrates, Socrates is talking to his friends. He's trying to reassure them that although he's been sentenced to die by drinking hemlock, that they shouldn't be saddened by that. And he goes through arguments for the immortality of the soul. He outlines a view of the soul as entrapped in the body, and we clearly have a dualism of mind and body. He ultimately argues for the immortality of the soul in a way that undoubtedly has come down to us through religious traditions. He argues for the immortality of the soul in a number of ways. And then, interestingly, in a wonderfully self-critical passage, Socrates, who's the subject of the dialogue, says, but maybe I'm giving you these arguments today, my friends, and maybe you are accepting them only because this is the day I am to die.
Hmm. That's a powerful dialogue. And the interesting thing also about Plato and his idealism, I think, and I wonder what you have to say about this is, and this is also to quote Nietzsche, I believe, said that Plato or Socrates, either one of them, turned reason into a tyrant. And there was, I think, a sense in which this world of the forms and the use of reason could give you all the answers, and that from there you could arrive to truth, right?
Yes, I think behind Nietzsche's vision of Plato making reason a tyrant is that Plato does have this explicit tripartite vision of the soul. It's one that's echoed in the idea of modularity in contemporary brain sciences, where we think of the brain as doing different things in different parts, in different modules. Well, in Plato, there's this concept of the soul, the tripartite soul, that's envisaged as two horses with a charioteer. And one of the horses is desire. And another horse is, in Greek, it's thumos. It's courage in battle. It's when we say somebody has guts, a Greek saying the word thumos would have slapped his abdomen. That's what he's talking about, is that
fire in the belly.
Strength in battle. Yes, fire in the belly. And both of those are controlled, should be controlled, Plato thinks, by the charioteer, who's much more than a horse, and that's reason, that's rationality, and that's Nietzsche's tyrant.
I'm curious, this is something that I don't think you addressed in your lecture, and it's something that I've never really learned, which is how this progression happened between the pre-Socratics, who had this materialist view, right? This is where we got the idea of atoms and the idea that the universe is all formed out of the material stuff that we have and see in the world, and to this progression to Plato and idealism and mathematics as sort of the fundamental nature of reality. Is there a clear history for how that happened, how that transition happened?
There's a real interesting interregnum there, which even since I've been doing the lectures, I've become more interested in, which is the role of the Pythagoreans. Coming from Pythagoras, you know the Pythagorean theorem. Well, the Pythagorean theorem is Pythagoras. Supposedly, when he invented it, he was so, or discovered it, depending on your view of mathematics, he was so ecstatic that he sacrificed some large number of cattle as a thanks for the Pythagorean theorem. But he had a number of followers. It was really a school. It later becomes impossible to tell whether something came from Pythagoras himself or one of the later Pythagoreans. And we're talking about between 500 and 300 BC, overlapping, in some ways anticipating, Plato. And the Pythagoreans are really interesting in a number of regards, and I think they are the best candidate for a transition from the materialist Ionian thinkers that I mentioned and Plato. They're interesting because where Thales thought water was the main thing, Anaximenes thought the cosmos was made of air, Heraclitus of fire, Leucippus and Democritus, these particles dancing in the void, the Pythagoreans had a very different view of what the substance of the universe was, and scholars still aren't sure precisely how to read it. The Pythagoreans thought that the universe was made of number. What sense does it make to think that things are made of numbers? There are passages in the Pythagoreans that suggest, yeah, they thought everything was made of numbers, but they thought that numbers were somehow material. There are other passages that contemporary mathematicians tend to like that seem to suggest, no, that this was something very different, that this was an idealistic view of the universe. The other thing about the Pythagoreans, beyond that they've got a different kind of thing, a radically different kind of thing out of which they think the universe is made, is that it seems to be through the Pythagoreans that certain elements of an Orphic tradition are incorporated into Western philosophy. And part of the Orphic tradition, which may well have come from the East, is the idea of the transmigration of souls. And that has to involve a notion of a soul distinct from body, because that's what a soul is migrating between, is different bodies. So souls have to be different from bodies. And in Plato, in the Phaedo, one of the arguments for the immortality of the soul is based on this concept of transmigration of the souls. So although there is a dialogue of Plato's that has Socrates being importantly critical of the Pythagoreans, it looks like both certain elements of the reality of the ideal and certain elements of a concept of souls as distinct from bodies may be coming to Plato from the Pythagoreans. And although it's wild speculation, it looks like those ideas may have come to the Pythagoreans from the East.
Do we have any sense of where initial ideas of immortality came from? Because there isn't, I mean, if you grow up Christian when you're young, I think you conflate Christianity, or, well, Christianity certainly has an afterlife, but you conflate religion with notions of immortality, and those things aren't necessarily conjoined. And I believe also the Old Testament doesn't talk anything about it, doesn't speak about an afterlife as far as I know. Do we have a sense of when these ideas entered Western philosophy, this idea of an afterlife, which is inherent in Plato's forms and his idealism?
Again, it's hard to say, and you get sort of lost in translation, or at least being bewildered by the varieties in translation. It's easy to think that our contemporary ideas, not only our contemporary beliefs, but the categories we use, are somehow from time immemorial. And when you start looking at even the furthest reaches of time immemorial, you find that that's not true. That it's not just, oh, everybody must always have had a concept of body. Everybody must always have had a concept of mind, a concept of soul that are somehow distinct from body. But what you find when you go back are quite various traditions which more or less match elements of these, but it's hard to say that any of them is the strand that leads directly to us. With the concept of soul, for example, which once you get to Descartes is explicitly identified with mind. But with the concept of soul, certainly everybody always had a concept of soul. Well, maybe. When you try to trace it back, the term soul itself is Anglo-Saxon. It appears in Beowulf. But it's something that leaves when you die. In Beowulf, it's something like, from his breast went his soul to seek the judgment of the righteous. But that's 700 AD. And if you want to go earlier than that, you have to use a term that's different from that, we tend to translate the Greek psyche as soul, but even that term changes over time in Greek literature. So if you contrast Homer and Plato, for example, in Homer, which might be one of our earliest sources, you have the concept of psyche, but psyche is something that when a hero dies, leaves his mouth like breath, descends through the earth, and becomes a shadow or an echo or an image of him in Hades, but it's not clear that image has consciousness. And it's certainly not that it's him. The hero is gone. All that's left is his psyche. Now, if you translate psyche as soul, that's sort of an odd concept of soul. It's more like a ghost. And is a ghost a soul? I don't know.
Souls in the underworld were very much like zombies. They didn't know who
yes.
they were. They didn't remember who they were, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
In a sense, also, you're touching on there what you've touched on in prior statements, which is this, there's a sense in which soul is very much couched in the material. There's a sense in which the soul has this outline, and it's very much something we understand in the context of the material world. Does that make sense? I mean, does that kind of leading in the correct direction with that?
I would tend to think that, no, maybe it's in the other direction, that the soul is an anti-material element in some way. I think it is in Plato. When you get to the Phaedo, the soul is trapped inside the body, but it's clear that the trapped is a metaphorical trap, not that one physical thing is trapped inside another thing. So I tend to think that when we try to say, oh, that's a concept of soul, and we try to identify it with what we're familiar from our religious upbringing or from the general culture, it tends to be a non-material thing. You mentioned Aristotle, who's really interesting in contrast to Plato, because Plato is a dualist. You have two things. You have a body and you have a soul, and the soul is trapped inside the body, supposedly freed at death to go and join the abstract realm of the forms. In Aristotle is often spoken of as bringing Plato down to earth. There's this famous painting of the School of Athens, that two of them are walking side by side, and Plato is pointing to the heaven, or pointing upwards. Aristotle is pointing down, and it's a painting envisaging that Plato thinks reality is in this realm of the abstract forms. Aristotle was very much a biologist and thought of living things as living things. And in fact, when he talks about soul, he's got a book called On the Soul. When he talks about the soul, he says it's the form of the body. It's not a form in the body. It's not something spiritual trapped in the body. It's like a shape. It's the sort of functional shape that a living organism, including people, has. So in the same way a candle flame has a shape, a body has a soul.
Like an aura.
Well, yeah, it's a character. It's a how it moves, how it lives, how it functions, what its trajectory, its functional trajectory is. But one of the consequences is Plato wants the soul to be immortal. Aristotle, because he thinks it's a character of the body, quite explicitly says that it's not immortal. When the candle flame goes, its shape doesn't linger. And when the body goes, if the soul is its functioning activity doesn't somehow remain. Interestingly, that contrast is carried even further into the Middle Ages, where the two classic Christian medieval philosophers are Augustine, writing about 400 AD, and Aquinas, writing about 1250 AD, Augustine is a Platonist. He thinks the body is trapped in the soul. He's continuing the tradition of Plato. Aquinas tries to be an Aristotelian. He tried to make Aristotle Christian or Christianity Aristotelian, one of the two, depending on your point of view. But the result is we've got directly contradictory passages in the two major Christian philosophers, where Augustine explicitly says, I am my soul. And Aquinas quite explicitly says, I am not my soul.
When you were talking about Aristotle, the way I've read Aristotle, the way I think about his view of the soul is it seems similar to these emergent theories of consciousness in a way. Is there any similarity between our theories that consciousness emerges from the physical interactions of our neurochemical brains or the sort of whatever, some aspect of the material world, and Aristotle's view that the soul is this character of the physical body?
Yeah, absolutely. When we outlined some positions before, we outlined materialism and idealism and dualism. And all of those are trying to answer the question of what is the world made of? What is the cosmos, including minds, made of? Is it material? Is it physical? Is it somehow, in the end, subjective experience that somehow the material is built out of? Is it two basic substances, as in dualism? There's actually a fourth view that is well represented in 20th century and 21st century philosophy of mind that says not only that those views aren't quite right, but that they're asking the wrong question. They're acting as if in order to understand the mind, we have to understand what it's made of. But there are plenty of things you want to understand where you're not understanding what they're made of. If you want to understand hurricanes, you're not going to just be happy in knowing what they're made of. In order to understand a hurricane, you have to understand a dynamics, how something moves, how certain things relate. And the contemporary view is called functionalism. And the idea is the mind isn't the body, the mind isn't the brain. In Marvin Minsky's terms, the mind is what the brain does, its function. You get very much this view in Daniel Dennett, that the mind is a process as opposed to a thing. And that appears in Aristotle. In Aristotle, it's the function of something that is what characterizes the mind. So yes, Aristotle might be thought of as the first functionalist, although the view is much more detailed and elaborated in 20th and 21st century philosophy.
Well, I think Dennett has said, or sort of quipped, that the hard problem of consciousness, Chalmers' hard problem, isn't that hard after all, because the view is that simply it is something that emerges and there's nothing really there. It's not really a problem to be solved. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Dennett is very much a critic of the supposed hard problem of consciousness. Yes. He, along with Paul and Patricia Smith Churchland, think they're isn't such a big problem, that the problem is blown out of proportion, that when we really do understand things, we'll understand that there isn't that big a problem. And so they're both, Daniel Dennett and the Churchlands, are ultimately materialists, but they're materialists in the sense that, oh, the only thing that exists is the physical universe. So the mind is in some sense physical, but it's the function of the thing, the dynamics of the thing, that is the appropriate level of analysis. And of course, there are all of these thought experiments that are intended to disprove materialism, and Dennett and the Churchlands are very much critics of those thought experiments as well.
Now we're starting to really focus in and drill in on what that problem is, right? Because I think both Paul and Patricia, they're both neuroscientists, correct?
They're philosophers first. Interestingly, their children are neuroscientists. They've had plenty of experience working elbow by elbow with practicing neuroscientists. They're philosophers by training, but their children are working neuroscientists.
So is it fair to say that materialism has gained so much traction and become sort of the dominant philosophy? Well, first of all, is it fair to say that that is sort of in scientific circles and in mainstream circles more broadly the sort of dominant view?
Absolutely. That's the default view. That's what many people think has to be true, that somehow, yes, the universe is ultimately a physical universe. Everything that's real has to somehow fit in a picture of the physical universe, and that's materialism. That is indeed what I would say the overwhelming bulk of philosophers, certainly the overwhelming bulk of people in the brain sciences, believe.
Now, for me, the way I interpret it, and I've seen this written very differently and expressed differently by others, but for me, the hard problem is that any theory of consciousness, at least let's talk about materialism for a second here, any materialist theory requires, it emerges from a conscious mind's process. In other words, the theory is created by consciousness to explain itself. Would that be one way of talking about the hard problem? In other words, that scientific, that empirical science requires the ability to measure something objectively. But we're all having subjective experiences, so there is no objective measurement if what we're trying to do is get to axiomatic truths. So I think that's also another way of getting at really the core question here is, what can we know definitively, right? And that brings us back to Descartes, who asked the question, what do I know? Or what can I say definitively? And his famous answer was that I exist, or I think, therefore I am. Can you sort of lay out what that hard problem is for us?
Yes. I can only lay it out in terms that neither Dennett nor the Churchlands are going to like, because the very terms in which the problem is posed, they think is part of the problem. But in perfectly understandable, normal terms, the problem is, if there's an objective world of physical things, the kinds of things you trip over in the dark, how in that picture can you find a place for subjective experiences? So put it this way, inside your head, inside your skull, is 3.5 pounds of matter, of gray matter, some 100 billion neurons, trillions of synapses, but the brain has been said to be the size of a coconut, the shape of a walnut, the color of uncooked liver, the consistency of chilled butter. How can that thing be what's behind, and now the only way you can express it is by spreading your hands in front of you and saying, all this, my subjective experience, this movie that is my life, that isn't something that is, just a piece of matter. That's something that, in order to be what it is, has to be experienced. It's the realm of my experience. How do those things go together? How can that realm of experience be explained by that pound of matter? In order to see how hard the hard problem is, not only don't we have an answer for what is it about brains that produce subjective experience, it's not clear what an answer would look like. Because if I told you, I do have the answer, I know exactly what consciousness consists in. It consists in, and I give you a very specific description of a pattern of neuronal firing in particular parts of the brain. I lay all that out. I say, you see, it's this X pattern that produces consciousness.
Correlates is what you're...
Right, a neuronal correlate. And the problem will always be, it doesn't seem any way to get around the problem. The problem will always be, okay, I see what happens in my brain when I taste a pineapple, but why does that in my brain generate the taste of pineapples? Why isn't that just a pattern of neuronal firing in a physical substance? Where does this subjective experience come from? Mm-hmm. That's the basic core of the hard problem of consciousness.
So basically the thing is, why does there need to be a subjective experience? What's the reason for that? But I have a second question, or I think a question that's even primary to that, which is, how can we make definitive statements about the world using the scientific method about the nature of reality from our own subjective experience? Where does that fit in this conversation?
I'm not sure it has a firm place. I think the only answer to that is, yes, we're all dealing with our own subjective experiences on the theory that there are multiples of us, that we're not solipsists, that I think that you exist, for example. Then what we do is we communicate things, we coordinate views, and maybe our view of the world at any particular time, and these things change, is a socially coordinated vision that we can each find our subjective experiences in, but that we also hypothesize individually and collectively extends beyond the range of those subjective experiences. If we were trapped in our subjective experiences, if we thought that all that was real was what I am experiencing, what we have socially agreed to call mad. There's a joke that Russell told at some point where solipsism is the view, by the way, that the only thing that exists is what I experience. And Russell tells the story of someone approaching him and saying, and Russell at one point wrote that there's nothing illogical about solipsism. In fact, there's no way to disprove the solipsist view that exists as his own experience. But he tells the story of someone coming up and saying, I love what you wrote about solipsism. I think solipsism is true. I wish more people thought that. The joke, of course. Yes.
Well, that's interesting. Is it fair to say, though, that solipsism is a sort of like a hallucination? The idea of that is that it's a hallucination, that nothing is real, that the only thing that's real is that there is this person or is this entity having an experience, or the experience itself, perhaps, is the only thing that's real, insofar as the way we think about what's real. But what I'm sort of getting at is this idea that everything we experience is a simulation in some sense or another. It's a model of the world. It isn't the world as it truly is. In that sense, I've always found Chalmers' approach to this most attractive from my perspective. He has some very interesting ideas, and most recently when I've heard him talk about this, he actually takes some ideas that out of information theory, specifically Tononi's integrated information theory, and quantum mechanics, and sort of fuses them together and has these really interesting ideas about how this might create a unified theory of consciousness, always putting consciousness at the center. What do you think about some of the ideas that he's proposed, this idea of computational theoretical approaches to the problem of consciousness, and the way that this perhaps integrates with the latest findings or some of the sort of alternative theories of physics?
Chalmers is one of those who thinks that we're not going to solve the hard problem by keeping our basic scientific categories and just fiddling at the edges. He thinks that a radical change is required, that he thinks there is one universe. He's a monist. He thinks things do relate. But given the fact that consciousness is part of the universe, we've got to build it into the theory. And he thinks we sort of have to build it in all the way down, that we have to have a physics that includes consciousness. Now, one claim is that we need that kind of theory. Another claim is a series of claims regarding what role that might take in such a theory. And the information theoretic approach of Tononi and others fits in at that point. I'm not convinced that that's going to work. It's a problem of envisaging what the theory would look like and whether it would do what it's supposed to do. I said before that the hard problem is so hard that not only don't we have a theory, a materialistic, say, materialistically based theory of consciousness, it's not clear what any such theory would look like. Anything material you hand me looks inadequate to explain subjective experience. Not only don't we have something you can hand me that does, it's hard to imagine how anything you handed me from that realm would. But the same thing seems to be true of the kinds of things that Chalmers and Tononi envisage. Because suppose we built physics all the way down and we added a new particle that was the consciousnessitron. It's the thing that is carrying consciousness that's part of built into things. There would still be the questions of why does the consciousnessitron produce consciousness? And just saying it's there doesn't yet tell us how that part works. Similar problems may be there in Tononi. It's very attractive to think that at least a necessary condition of consciousness is integrated information. It's not clear that that would give us a sufficient condition. And many of the critiques of Tononi have relied on that problem, where He's got some very impressive mathematical definitions of integration of information. The claim that those give us consciousness, or that those are consciousness, repeatedly runs into difficulties like there's plenty of integrated information on the CD-ROM that you pop into your computer. In at least some forms, it even satisfies Tononi's mathematical formula for consciousness. But unless you think your CD-ROM is conscious, we don't yet have a sufficient condition for consciousness.
Can you explain for our audience Tononi's integrated information theory, and also maybe give them some understanding of what information theory is, how far back it goes to the time of Shannon and Turing, and how that has been weaved together to provide a theoretical framework for consciousness?
That's a big question. I can only maybe start to give something like a thumbnail sketch.
I would say maybe this. I mean, for example, from my own knowledge of this, I think one really important revelatory concept is the concept of information, something that almost everyone doesn't really have a proper sense of, right? In the same way that, and I would say in the same way that Newton transformed language around motion and mass, for example, Shannon changed what we think of as information. So I think that at a very basic level is something that people need to understand in the context of this conversation to sort of begin to understand what we're talking about here with this theory of consciousness.
I think you're absolutely right that the concept of information is crucial. It's one that we are working with more and more. I think it's still in the process of development. I'm not sure we really do have a settled concept of information that these are things or theories about. I think we have theories in the general area that we call theories of information, but they sort of define information their own way. So, for example, if you take Shannon, who explicitly characterizes his as a mathematical theory of information and is often taken that way, he's also explicit that it's only information in a limited sense. He was working for Bell Labs. He was trying to figure out how many signals you could get across a wire without compromising them, how much redundancy you needed in order to assure certain levels of accuracy. But it's really syntactical, and it really has to do with, if I give you these three pieces of information, how predictable is the fourth one? And the less predictable something is, the more information I've given you. If I tell you something that everybody already knows, that we breathe air, I haven't given you much information. That was predictable based on what you already had. If I tell you there's a fire in your bathroom, I may be giving you information you didn't already have. That's a lot of information. You might not have predicted that on the basis of what you already knew. That's Shannon information. It's the unpredictable.
It's surprise. It's synonymous with surprise.
It's surprise. It's surprise. And when you define it in terms of a series of bits of like ones and zeros, and you go, how much information is contained in the fifth bit? It's how predictable was that bit from the previous four? If the series is 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, then, it's pretty predictable. If the series is purely random, it's unpredictable, but that gives us something that is true in Shannon, that is something that real information theory will want to avoid, namely that the thing that carries most information is a random series, mm-hmm. is static. When you look at a static on a TV, you don't say, now I'm really getting information. That's another kind of non-information. And I'm not saying that there have not been wonderful attempts to try to get some kind of middle ground where a monotonous message doesn't have information and randomness isn't information. There's something in between that is genuinely informative.
And there's probability theory obviously plays an important role here. This is how we get compression as well, right? It's mm-hmm. why film mm-hmm. compresses easier than, let's say, a picture, because it's more predictable. You know from one frame what the next frame will be roughly, and you can predict that.
Right.
And in physical systems, in physics, the corollary here is entropy, right? And as the universe moves towards entropy, it moves towards maximum amount of information. And the side of intelligence is order of information, right? It's that, like you said, somewhere between pure monotonous boring predictability and pure, you know, randomness to some complexity.
Yes, that's right. And that's the kind of concept we want to capture in a real theory of information. But I think we're still working toward that. It's not Shannon information. There are other developments since, many of which are very interesting. Tononi is really interesting on the topic. My friend Luciano Floridi is probably the preeminent man in philosophy of information. And I don't think he thinks that we've got it tacked down yet either.
Well, you know, sticking on this sort of, because this is within the realm of computational theoretical approaches, there's one other sort of popular approach, which is this idea of reverse engineering the mind by trying to create a computer or achieve consciousness by the creation of computers, right? And this is part of research that's happening in artificial intelligence. I guess my first practical question is, how much of the energy and time and resources that have been devoted to work in GoFi and good old-fashioned artificial intelligence have been towards solving this theoretical problem of consciousness? And to the extent that they have, how successful have those approaches been?
I think very little have been motivated by that. Usually it's a much more, whether it's GoFi or a neural network connectionist approach, the people that I've known in artificial intelligence are interested in, but not primarily motivated by a question of consciousness. I think many of them think that, oh yes, consciousness must be an emergent phenomena of some kind in complex systems of some type, but it's not that they've been out to look for it. It's been, oh, if it's emergent, then it'll emerge. Now, how we know when it has, that's a good question too.
Well, have you watched Westworld? Have you seen that show?
I haven't, but I do know the premise. Yes, yes.
It also, I think the first season, if I'm not mistaken, I think we're in the second season now, or maybe the third season, and I've watched every episode, but I think it's in the first season where they touch on Jaynes's bicameral theory of mind, and there's a sense in which these robots become conscious. They sort of become self-aware in a sense. But of course, there is that problem. This is like, you're kind of touching on the Turing test, I guess, here, right? But the Turing test doesn't actually tell you whether an artificial machine is actually conscious, if it's having a subjective experience or if it's just mimicking all of that. It's so good, it's so computationally excellent that it can mimic, you know, it can completely fool a human being into thinking that it's conscious. And how would you ultimately know? Just like I don't know if you're conscious and you don't know if I'm conscious, and some people actually, we question that openly if they're conscious or not, how would we be able to tell at some point, ultimately, if a computer were conscious? Can we?
I don't know. I do know, however, that you're conscious. I'm confident that other people are conscious. I'm not sure how we would know whether a machine was conscious or not. Because in some sense, we don't really have the ultimate revealing test for consciousness. Turing started out with the question, can a machine think? But he didn't try to answer it, or a contemporary form might be, can a machine be conscious? He didn't try to answer it. He rejected it as meaningless. He rejected it as meaningless, I think, because he thought it was not subject to empirical test. And he substituted for that a question that he thought was answerable, and that was, could you build a machine that, in the course of 5 minutes of questioning, the person asking the questions didn't have more than a 60% chance of being able to identify whether it was a machine or a human? And of course, there is an instantiation of the Turing test, the Leibniz competition, every year, that has people submit programs and has people try to judge whether they're talking to a human or whether they're talking to a machine. Leibniz offers a gold medallion and an exorbitant amount of money for somebody who successfully produces a machine that can do that. And so far, no, there hasn't been a program that can fool a majority of judges into thinking it's a machine. into thinking it's a human, although there have been some humans who, intentionally or not, have led the judges to believe they were machines.
Well, one of our prior guests, John Borthwick of BetaWorks, Bill told me on air that he had built a bot called Botwick after himself, and when posed the question, "Are you a bot?" the bot was programmed to answer, "Are you, are you an investor?" So you know that I take your point. All right, so I guess in closing, I'm curious to know from you what theories or theory you find most compelling, and if you have any at all, maybe you're just a pure mystic, and. What do you think is on the horizon in this area, this philosophical discipline, and in resolving this problem that you think is most sort of promising?
Actually, my view is an approach that isn't generally taken. I want to be a materialist. I'll be straightforward about that. But I think the hard
You want to be, is that what you said?
I would like to be a materialist.
Why would you like to be a materialist?
Well, for one thing, I want to be a monist. I want the world to be all one thing. Materialist, maybe I'm saying that too strong. I want it to be all one thing. It may not be the thing we think it is, or it may not be made solely of the material stuff we think it is. There may be more complicated aspects of, I would tend to think, organization rather than the stuff they're made of that we are unaware of, and that's where we will find consciousness, is somewhere in this functionalist idea of the material realm. So it's not that we'll find something spooky in the universe, but what we want to understand is the apparently spooky ways in which the physical universe ultimately operates. I actually have an idea for how I don't think we yet have a science of consciousness. The Churchlands and Dennett seem to think that we already have everything that we need. We just have to keep plugging away and that we'll get what we want. I'm not sure that's true, but I do have a sort of a set of steps that I think could lead us to a legitimate science of consciousness. The first one, when I said that it's a way that isn't often pursued, although it's been invoked, is I think it would help a lot if we could figure out what consciousness does that unconscious processes don't. If consciousness is real, in beings like us, it had to evolve. And it's at least a good hypothesis that if it evolved, it evolved for a reason, that we get something by being conscious that other thing that our zombie twins don't have. So the question is, there's plenty of things that we do, there's plenty of things that operate in our brain that are not on a conscious level. They function just fine. Your digestive system operates just fine. Your reaction system under stress works just fine. And they aren't conscious. On the other hand, there are things you do that are conscious. What is it that those give you that the other things don't? What is it that evolution selected for in us, in mammals, in other beings, that consciousness does? What is it that consciousness is good for? I'd like to know that.
Anxiety.
Yeah, well, then what does anxiety get you? Well, is there something that being anxious gets you that just having certain hormones that produce certain reactions doesn't get you, being consciously anxious?
Well, we also know that certain traits genetically are ride-along. I mean, we get them just because...
That's right. Yeah. That's right. When I said it was a hypothesis that it gets us something, I think it is a hypothesis.
So maybe this is one big screw-up. We didn't.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Not everything that an evolved organism has was evolutionarily selected for. There are things about your blood that were selected for, namely that it carries oxygen. That it was red wasn't selected for. There's no evolutionary advantage to your fluid being red, unless it's tied to it being oxygen-carrying. They're called spandrels in evolutionary theory. They're things that are along for the ride. And evolution it doesn't just look for what works. It works with what it has at hand. And it could be that what was evolutionarily advantageous was an organism that was able to react in contexts a certain way, and that the brain stuff that was at hand that it could do that with happen to be a conscious thing. So it's possible it has no evolutionary advantage. That would mean that this thing that we think of as a gem in the universe, the shining light of an objective universe, subjectivity, is an accident, is a freak.
We have to
of
go
nature.
Back. We've got to go back to the tragedians then for answers and kick out the philosophers and go straight for the poets.
I tend to think it probably has, but it's a guess, it's a hypothesis, that consciousness probably has something it can do that other systems can't. If we knew that what that was, then we could start to try to formalize some kind of abstract representation of the process that is that evolutionary advantageous thing. At that point, if there's something that consciousness does, if we can identify it and we can formalize it, then the question is, okay, and how is it instantiated in the brain? How is that process something that the brain does? That, I think, would give us a scientific theory of consciousness. We'd know how it functions, what it does, and how the brain produces those functions. We don't have any of those steps, and there are a couple paradoxical steps in there. The first step is the one you already mentioned, that yes, there's a hypothesis that there's something that consciousness does that unconscious processes can't, and maybe that's not true. The second step is, if we could formalize it, if we could not only identify it, but make something like a consciousness algorithm, then the second paradox is, well, we could then build a conscious machine. If we knew consciousness was this procedure A to B to C, then there seems only one reason why we couldn't build a machine that does that A to B to C, and that is that you can't do it with the kinds of machines we can. Maybe that we have. Maybe electronics can't do it. Maybe you need wetware. Maybe you need something unique to brains to do that. That's sort of the second paradox. But yes, I would like to understand consciousness. I think the way to do it is to first of all figure out what it does, then figure out how it does it, and then figure out how the brain does that thing it does.
Let me ask you one last question, because I think this is the one that maybe a lot of people in the audience are asking, not just of you, but even themselves, which is, why is this important? And this is a question that I don't have an answer to. I mean, I'm driven to ask the question. I've been driven to ask the question of what is the nature of my experience, of this experience of life since I was as young as I can remember. But I never, ever, ever, and up to this day, had a good answer. I guess I could say death anxiety plays a role in it. I think early on there was a desire and a hope that somehow, to go back to Nietzsche and Plato's turning reason into a tyrant, I had a hope that somehow I could reason my way to some notion of immortality, some notion of continuity after death. It might just simply be a evolution of my behavioral psychology. But why do you think, or why is it important to you, and why do you think maybe more broadly it's a question that should concern us?
I think it's one of those questions that is inevitable to anybody who thinks deeply. If you're asking for what is the practical value of trying to answer that question, I'm not sure that there's going to be an answer that says that its practical value is this or that. But there are plenty of questions that are more important than the practical, and I think this is one of them. I've got a question for you, Dimitri.
Oh, wow, this is the first time that's happened, I got to say. No one's ever done that to me.
Because you were talking about early thoughts about this kind of thing, childhood thoughts about this kind of thing, and I just want to know whether you have the same experience I have in this way. So this is pure autobiography, and it's asking whether you've got autobiography that matches. Not only do I think that, oh, my first glimmerings of some of these ideas happened when I was a child, I know where they happened, because I can envisage the street that I grew up in great detail. Not only can I envisage it, I live there part of the time. When I'm thinking about things, I wander as if I'm a five-year-old up and down that street, thinking five-year-old thoughts and practically identifying physical places with certain ways of thinking about certain things. Do you have any such experience?
If I connect my memory of physical landscapes to ideas?
Yeah.
It's an interesting question. No?
I'm anticipating you to say no.
Well, no, it's an interesting question. I can't immediately... There's something that rings true about that. It's a very interesting question. I certainly have a visual memory where there are visions that are associated with feelings and ideas. And when I think about the past, I mean, for example, one memory I have of sort of consulting these existential questions was alone in my bed in York, Pennsylvania, because I spent 4 years in Pennsylvania as a child. And I remember lying in that room thinking about eternal nothingness, this idea of, I remember this was in my head, what if there is nothing after death and that would be eternal nothingness, and trying to contemplate that, and it felt like a circuit broke, like in my brain. It felt like, I don't know that it was so much a sort of an anxiety that filled me or anything like that. It was more just an unfathomable, it didn't compute, it didn't work within my mind. So in that sense, I remember being in my bed in the dark, if that's what you mean. It's an interesting question. Why do you ask that, I wonder?
Oh, it was mere curiosity.
Hmm. Well, that's very interesting. You turned the tables. You turned the microphone onto me. You caught me by surprise. It was a great moment. Historic moment in the history of the show. Professor, it was my honor having you on. As I said, you have more than one lecture, but the one that I heard, I think it's the second most popular ever on the Great Courses, and it's not a surprise if you listen to it, and anyone that's heard you today, you're a great lecturer. In fact, I'd say I'd compare you to Ray Monk. We had Ray Monk on episode 11 to talk about philosophical mathematics, and there's a great similarity in the succinctness and clarity of both of your styles, and I definitely would highly recommend anyone download that lecture if they're interested in getting a much deeper understanding of these concepts and your perspective on them. I think you do a fantastic job of laying it out. And I thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
And that was my episode with Patrick Grimm. I want to thank Dr. Grimm for being on my program. If you're a regular listener to the show, take a moment to review us on iTunes. Each review helps more people find the show and join our amazing community. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.